We're celebrating a Prairie Public milestone on Sunday, the 200th episode of our monthly program, Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life. Our program manager, Eric Deffritz, sits down with Why host Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and his wife and the show's announcer, Dr. Kim Dunhauer. You'll hear from some other folks who know Jack well, including fellow academics and colleagues, radio collaborators, and a very important member in his family.
Well, you know his voice. I mean, it kind of sticks out a little bit compared to the Midwest tones you normally hear on Prairie Public. But hey, that's a good thing, because every time you hear Jack Russell Weinstein, you know you're going to get a thought-provoking conversation that's accessible, yet doesn't insult your intelligence on things in life, big and small, through the lens of a popular UND philosophy teacher you wish you always had. Hey, Dr. Jack, welcome.
I am happy to be here, although I am not the one with the accent. You are the one with the accent.
we're the strange ones. Well, I have actually not even a Midwest accent, although, you know, I think I may have lost my Baltimoreese over the years. It's kind of smoothed out a little less cockneyed.
My New Yorker comes out when I get angry and excited.
Oh, boy.
And so do the words that I can't say on the radio, but that's part of the New York experience.
Well, I hope if we hear it, Jack, it's the excitement part that we're going to hear. But we brought along another voice that you're probably familiar with. You hear her with some of the credits on the show, and she was even a guest at one point on Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Your wife, Dr. Kim Dunhauer.
Hello.
Right. Hi. Yep. It's good to have you both, Kim and Jack, and I'm talking to you because of a milestone, a 200th one to be exact, 200 episodes of Why. How are you both feeling about it?
It's pretty exciting and connected with the fact that we're monthly and so that it's been 18 years. That's the thing that adds such power to the 200, because I can't even fathom. I can count to 10 pretty well, but 200, that's a lot in 18 years. So much water under the bridge, so many people, so many ideas that challenged me, that I find myself reflecting on 5, 10, 15 years later, and that really helped me understand the whole shebang, the whole connectedness of all of the knowledge. It humbles me to think about how much my guests and my listeners have contributed to my understanding of the world.
Do you agree with that, Kim? Do you see it through a little bit different lens?
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's interesting from my perspective is because the topic changes from month to month, is it means that Jack is always reading about, like, it could be the philosophy of anything, right? And so that will affect just conversations we have in the house, things we talk about. And so there's this wonderful sort of randomness of like, oh, this month the intellectual theme is philosophy of gardening. And next month it might be, you know, NCAA sports. And so there's always something different to talk about, to think about. But then also how many times Jack will refer back to one of the shows, you know, and say, I was thinking of this, but, you know, it was like the show when. He clearly has every episode in his head, remembered, cross-connected, filed away.
To that point, you learn a lot from doing these episodes. I mean, you know a lot of stuff. You read everything, and you have a memory like no other, according to your wife. But what do you learn over these 18 years? What have you learned about yourself, about life, just by doing this show that you wouldn't have learned otherwise?
The most important thing that I retained is the joy of performing discovery. And what I mean by that, and I really enjoy this about teaching as well, we have no models in our popular culture of people who are thinking on the camera. You ask a politician, you ask a talking head, they have the answer pat in the exact words instantaneously, and everything happens so quickly and everyone's fighting with each other, and you don't get to see people think, and you don't get to see people be wrong, and you don't get to see people internalize the ideas that someone else is presenting for you. And so independent of individual ideas and specific insights, the thing that stays with me the most is what a tremendous joy it is to be imperfect and to compute the internalization in front of people so I can advocate for the audience as the host. But while I'm advocating for the audience, it is giving me permission to fully integrate these ideas in a way that maybe I wouldn't have if it was a one-way conversation.
And I've heard you say, Jack, before that when you first started doing the show, you know, it was mainly about the topics, mainly about your guests, and it took you a little while to feel comfortable in the shoes of the host and that the audience is vested in you, the radio personality. How has that realization evolved for you over the years?
As a philosopher, it felt very narcissistic to think of it in terms of me rather than the topic. And I had assumed that people would tune in because they were interested in the philosophy of suicide or music, the logic of jazz or something. And then I started to see that people would refer to it as Jack's show and who is Jack talking about? And this sense that the audience imbued with me a kind of trust is really meaningful. I get a lot of feedback from my best friend, Gail, who long-term listeners will know that I talk about all the time on the show. And one of the things she says is, oh, you had another show that I had absolutely no interest in at all, and I thought it was going to be completely boring, and then I listened to it, and I thought it was fascinating. And that sense of trust in me as a conversation partner allowed me to get past that fear of calling attention to myself, because it really is a gift for people to feel like they have that kind of relationship with me.
Well, you know, we all have relationships with radio personalities we grew up with. We even imagine what they look like. We imagine like what they're like at home, doing the dishes, taking out the trash. So since we have your better half in here,
now be nice.
Might as well ask the source, what is Jack, the radio personality, like in real life?
I'll tell you a story. When Jack and I first met, we were both living in California, teaching at Fresno State University, and I'm from the English department, and I got invited to a dinner party at the philosophy department. And after the conversation there, on the way home, I said to Jack, you guys are never not philosophers, are you?
That had to be a dinner party.
Jack is never not a philosopher in the way that he thinks about things and his ready access to all kinds of ideas, how they're connected to each other, his ability to explain those things. But one of the things that is so interesting to me is that philosophy is known for the way they sort of help each other think about things is to attack each other's ideas, mm-hmm. right? And I've found Jack as, you know, the show and having to be an interviewer and that advocate for the audience, he really has this different method now that I think works just as well as the attack each other's ideas to help people, you know, think better. He's really good at drawing out simply because of interest, of just very intense interest and listening, drawing out people's ideas, restating them in different ways to make sure he understands, but also the audience understands. And so he's the perfect person to have a conversation with if you've got an idea about something, but it needs development. We were doing that on the way down here today for something that I'm writing. I said, you know, I need you to help me think about this kind of thing. So he's the kind philosopher instead of the the stereotypical, but what about this? You're wrong about that, right? Philosopher that I think you might see if you went to the American Philosophical Association.
Well, one of my favorite little bits about our marriage is I will get a text and Kim will say, I have a question about something.
I call this dial of philosopher.
Yeah, she calls it dial of philosopher. And it's, you know, what could be better than your spouse valuing the things that you have to say?
Well, also, too, you don't turn off the academia, the great stimulating conversation. You happen to have that at home with an equal, and that has to be pretty exciting.
It is. It's great. Kim plays a tremendous role, obviously, in my day-to-day life, in my figuring out ideas and molding things, but what I think everyone should know is that she's also the first reader of the monologue. Every episode starts with a 5 or 6 minute discussion of me talking about themes and ideas, and she edits them. And she looks at them and tells me if something works and tells me if something doesn't. She's a fabulous editor. This idea isn't clear. Maybe move this paragraph. But the joy of coming up to her attic office and her saying, this was excellent, this was really good, I don't have very comments, that's a real accomplishment. And as the first reader, she's also in many ways, right, the most important reader. Yeah. Because if I can't get it past her, it's not good. And if I can get it past her, I don't have to worry about it being good.
It sounds like, Kim, you have a pretty good BS detector. And
I do. And, you know, and actually one of the ways that working with the monologues made me a better editor is because I used to work as a book editor. And mm-hmm. So my attitude used to just sort of be all business of like, okay, fix this, move this, do that. And then Jack would say, did you like any of it? And I'd realize, oh, I need to, you know, to tell him,
touch, yeah.
I need to tell him that too. But also, I mean, what that has let us do is like, there's certain moves he'll make in a monologue that I think work really well for the audience. And so it lets me suggest sometimes of like, or notice, you know, you didn't do that thing you usually do in the monologue. Like what if you did that? You know, so the benefits of the softer touch, but also of emphasizing what's working as well as just fixing what's not.
It's great to have somebody you trust and somebody you want to please at the same time. It's a good thing for a radio show. But speaking of that, Jack, I am just curious, are there any radio hosts out there that you kind of model your delivery after or just have been influential in the way you think about being a radio guy?
I tend to hear things that I don't want to do, as opposed to things that I do, in part because I'm always processing this mode of explanation. And the thing that stands out more than anything else when I listen to other podcasts or radio shows is how often people use ideas or talk about things that they don't explain. And so they'll use a term or reference a moment or what have you, and you're listening and you're thinking, I have no idea what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I wish they would just spend 10 seconds to just remind the audience, tell the audience, I don't know, what the offsides rule is, right? And it is so disruptive to the listening process that it allows me to try to step outside of myself and hear myself the way that other people would hear me. I think that the most influential people in terms of my delivery have been the Marx Brothers. Groucho Marx. I was profoundly influenced by the Marx Brothers. There's a figure, William M. Gaines, who was the editor and publisher of Mad Magazine for years, and actually the very first hardback I ever bought for myself was his biography, and that has had a profound effect on me. And this history of, and this connects to, of course, this month's episode of What is Jewish Philosophy, this voice of the Jewish way of exploring intellectual ideas with pleasure, joy, and playfulness, and to be able to make jokes out of the chaos that allows people to not feel threatened by the ideas. And that's not, I think, the answer that you expected, but the foundational experiences of what it means to be taken seriously by a whole person with ideas rather than just a narrow person with ideas is probably the most influential force for me on the radio and for me in the class. I read comments online about professors who are complaining and students don't do this or whatever. And my starting point is always absolute trust in my audience, absolute trust with my students that they can rise to the occasion and that I can reveal things about myself when they're relevant to the class and that the students can see me be both intellectually vulnerable and sometimes emotionally vulnerable and the audience for why the same way. They're not going to trust me if I don't trust them. And these comedic voices that are classic clowns and agents of chaos, they're the comic version of Godzilla, right? They're the sprite, the pixie, the chaotic creature storming through Tokyo and creating destruction that you have nothing but affection for. And being able to grow up in that environment and see those voices helped me understand what it means to be someone who takes pleasure in the process of undermining my own intellectual certainty, because that's where the fun begins.
That is a very thoughtful answer. And like you said, what I was not expecting.
That's what I do for a living.
But yeah, it is. But you can, it's great because, you know, obviously you're not in the, talking to you, the listener, you're not in the studio here. You don't see the wheels turning, but it's fun to actually see you behind the mic and hear the wheels turning, and you almost sort of get in this zen-like space. You close your eyes and you're really thinking, and the gears are grinding, but it all makes sense in the end. And like, you know, we've talked about, it's what's coming out of your mouth is very thoughtful, very smart, but very understandable.
I appreciate the kind words. Yeah. I do become very internal. I really have this dual experience of anticipating the words that I want to say and hearing the words as I say them to see if they came out as I anticipated. And my vision sort of fades and my awareness of the world disappears a little bit. I become very zen-like. I become very, it's not that I can visualize the words. It's more like I can watch the, like in the old movies or Raiders of the Lost Ark, when you see the plane with the line going through the map, I can see the line as it moves around and go in various circuitous ways. And that helps me understand when in the middle of a sentence, I have to go a different way. And actually, one of the things that has been really wonderful about the show is that because there's this trust between me and the audience, I can say things like, I'm not really sure how to ask this question, but, and then try, or I'll sometimes say, I'm going to ask the question first, and then I'm going to explain what it means, and then I ask the question, and then I ask the question in a different way. That inviting people into the process of the construction of the questions and the development of the ideas in process is a freedom that the long-form interviews give me that I wouldn't necessarily have if I was doing 5-7 minute exchanges on a very polished, very produced show.
So we talked a little bit about the physicality of being a radio host and sort of where you go and the maps that you draw in your mind. When you're in the classroom and you are teaching these kids, you're not constrained by headphones and a mic and you got to stay still. You can't be all demonstrative and stuff. Or do you bounce around the room or what do you like with your students? Do you get in their face? What?
I flail. I pace. I get loud. I am a very passionate and precise instructor, but that's not the right word. What I'm trying to do is fill the room with emotion so that the students have permission to have their own emotional reaction to the ideas. And that runs counter to a lot of the ways that people talk about philosophy, because philosophy professors will say you're not supposed to be emotional. You have to use logic. You have to use reason. You have to avoid these philosophies. You have to be strict. You have to refer to the text. And of course, I believe all of those things. But the students aren't going to, especially in North Dakota, the students aren't going to overcome their fear of speaking in front of class. Mm-hmm. They're not going to overcome their skepticism that they don't have anything to say. They're not going to have the courage to say something that they know I'm going to trap them into a corner after they say it without having this incredible emotional experience of the need to assert themselves. And so while I am a very difficult, demanding professor, they complain a lot about the work and the reading and all that sort of stuff. My goal is to fill the room with as much emotion as possible, because especially folks in this region, they're told to contain their emotions. They're told to be embarrassed by their emotions. They're told to hide their emotions. And in my classroom, you have the permission to feel things about ideas that most of them will never have the permission to feel in their entire educational career.
In a way, I don't want to simplify things, but in a way, it's like almost kind of culture shock for here comes this New Yorker, you know, into a Midwest classroom where everybody's, you know, been taught since they were little and going to church, you know, to be buttoned up and keep those emotions held in check. And in a way, you're kind of the opposite. You wear it on your sleeve. And so, like, I never thought about that as playing out in your classroom, but it's the obviously your classroom has a lot of EQ in it.
Many of the students have no idea what to make of me. And they're taken aback, and it's always fun on the first day of the semester, especially with the introductory classes, right, where I'll have 25 students who have never taken philosophy before, have never had me before, and four or five repeat students, and I'll be doing my thing, and the 25 students will be staring at me like I'm an alien from outer space, and the five students will be laughing their butts off because they're used to it. They know not to take it seriously in the way that they know not to take it seriously, and the other students haven't processed it. And that actually protects me in a variety of ways because we live in a highly politicized environment, and there's partisan stuff and there's religion stuff, and I can play off my foreignness, I can play off my Jewishness, I can play off my Jackness to basically say, that's fine, that's your opinion, but it doesn't convince me, so find another way to say it. And if I do my job well, which I don't always, but if I do my job well, they don't experience that as an attack or as undermining their intellectual ability. They experience it as the opportunity to dig deeper the way that we only have models of when it comes to sports. Years ago, I wrote this article right after on the anniversary of September 11th. I wrote this article about the way that people reacted to professors and things after September 11th. And one of the things I said is that we don't have any good models of educational development in our culture. The best models we have are the sports models. You have Rocky, and Rocky fails, and he trains, and so he succeeds a little bit, and then he loses, and then he trains, and he succeeds more, and then he wins, but then he loses, so he goes to his old opponent, and he learns from his old opponent, and he learns more, and over the process of the many movies, some of which are better than others, you watch him learn and embrace the effort. And we don't have any models of the effort of learning that the students have any exposure to. And now, of course, with AI and ChatGPT and all those things, all of the social pressures are to completely avoid the learning process. The goal is the answer. The goal is the LLM essay that they can submit that doesn't allow for the process of their engaging. And so what I try to do with my foreignness and my jackness, as Kimball will call it, Kim will sometimes say, you know, they received full jack. And what I try to do is exploit that foreignness, that difference, that alien aspect, so that they don't see in me the kind of judgments, criticisms, and demand for silence that they may see by their community, or you said their church, or their parents, or what have you. I don't represent their parents to them. I represent something else.
Maybe a little freedom.
Yeah, I'd like to think so, but you'd have to ask them.
Well, Jack and Kim, speaking of culture shock, let's turn it around the other way. When did you both come to North Dakota? When was that? And Kim, you're from Asheville, North Carolina, one of the most beautiful towns that you could think of with the thriving art scene and a lot of mountains. And Grand Forks obviously has none. Jack, you being from Washington Heights, New York City, sidewalks everywhere, buildings rising up. So what was that culture shock like? When was it? And describe your feelings when you first moved here.
So we moved in 2001, August of 2001, from Central California, which is where we had met. We were both teaching at Fresno State.
It's the ugly California. It's not the nice California.
Yeah, it's not the pretty California.
Well, Fresno
and Bakersfield are always the joke.
Right. Fresno's airport code is what? Fat.
Right? Is fat, yes.
Which
it is.
Nothing wrong with that.
It is. And both of us felt like we didn't quite fit on the West Coast culturally to begin with. So part of our first reaction was that the Midwest felt a little more comfortable than the West Coast had in certain ways, in that it was easier to talk to people. People didn't seem quite as standoffish in our experience in California. And we also loved that we didn't have to get in a car to go absolutely anywhere, that it was possible to walk. Otherwise, in terms of culture shock, I mean, for me, the flatness was really hard. I'm a mountain person. And there was a moment we were driving the two cars, and it was before cell phones, we had walkie-talkies to talk to each other. And when we made the turn at Fargo to get on 29, and it somehow got even flatter, I got on the walkie-talkie to Jack and said, I don't know if I can do this. But I have grown to appreciate the flat landscape, though I still exhale every time I go back to Asheville and see the mountains. The culture shock part for me actually was primarily about the students, because I'd gone to graduate school at the University of Minnesota. And so I thought, well, I've taught students from, you know, the upper Midwest, but UND students are indeed the quietest students I've ever taught. And I've taught in Maryland, North Carolina, Minnesota, California. They often don't even give you facial expressions. You know, you have no idea how you're doing. And everyone who comes here has to develop a repertoire of strategies to get them to talk. We all come up with different ones. But, you know, listening to things Jack was just saying, I feel like even after 25 years, I'm still trying to understand and figure out all of the different reasons why they don't talk. And I think the part about emotion is really key, because I remember a moment I was teaching a literature class. We had read Kafka's The Metamorphosis, which begins with a man waking up, finding out that he has turned into a giant cockroach. And an actual real discussion broke out among the students about whether this was a dream or we were supposed to think this was real. And the conversation, it turned into a debate. And I could see a student in the front getting so upset and so uncomfortable. And finally she said, you guys, stop. It's just a story. And I leaned forward and I said, shh, I live for this moment. You know, but emotion being attached to ideas about something fictional, you could tell she wanted to get up and leave the classroom, right? Mm-hmm. It made her really uncomfortable. So I think understanding what all needs to happen to make these students comfortable talking in a classroom, talking about ideas, talking about, you know, fiction, that's been the biggest adjustment. And then people need to use more spices in their food. I know that's a cliche, but they do.
They're getting there, maybe just a little bit, incrementally every year, right?
This won't be a surprise given what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. but for me, the hardest thing has been having such a large personality and liking the interaction of strangers in a way that a lot of folks in the region aren't comfortable with. And so I often give this scenario of the different places that we've lived. And I say, in New York, if you're waiting online in the grocery store and you make a joke to strangers, they laugh and talk back to you. In California, if you're online and you make a joke to someone, they think you're hitting on them and you want to take them home. In North Dakota, you make a joke and you talk to strangers. They look at you because they think you're going to kill them in your in their sleep.
That's hilarious.
And that sense of public decorum has been hard for me. But, of course, what you get more than anything else here that I can't imagine another place that I would have gotten is this sense of being connected to and educating and contributing to a community. When we first got here, the university will do this bus tour for the new faculty. They'll either go in the north or the south end. And so we did the north end. And I especially, and I'd spent a year in small town Kentucky, but it still wasn't as rural as North Dakota. And we drove the north end, and every town we stopped, we would have, you know, lunch in someone's garage, and every doctor would be from UND, and every lawyer would be from UND. And there was this sense of meaningfulness, and you really get the sense of educating and participating in a community. I had a colleague who passed away a few years ago, but he had been at UND for 44 years. And I think I once figured out that 2% of the state had been in his classroom. That is an incredible gift that I wouldn't get if I was still at Fresno State, that we wouldn't get if we were at Harvard, right? I mean, I think it's nice to feel useful. It's nice to feel like you have a skill that maybe other people don't have, and so you're valuable. And I remember one day I was going to vote, you know, for some election, and I go give my ID, and the woman checks me in, and she looks up, she goes, "How's the radio show going?" And
nice.
What can I ask for more than that? Our various deans who do fundraising and stuff will often talk about being on some ranch and the rancher talking about the radio show and knowing that on a Sunday when we're doing the broadcast version that people are going down 94, you know, heading from Bismarck, listening. That's the flip side of the inability to connect with strangers, is that there's a connectedness that once you are invited into is really, you feel seen, you feel acknowledged, you feel like you're in some kind of reciprocal relationship.
Your daughter, born and raised here in North Dakota, so she's a true North Dakotan, not a North Carolinian, not a New Yorker. What is her life like as a North Dakotan? Does she, she's a native North Dakotan, literally, like how does that work with you two?
Well, first I'll say she's very proud of being a native North Dakotan, and she will specify that she is from North Dakota. Like if we're somewhere meeting new people and I'll say, "Well, we live in Grand Forks, but I'm from North Carolina and Jackson," and she'll say, "I'm from North Dakota." Nice. You know, so it's very much part of her identity. She's also, though, very aware how she's a mixture of North Dakota, New York, and the Mountain South. There are interests, habits, even growing up listening to her accent was always kind of funny because we could hear North Dakota accent things. But if we'd been visiting my family, suddenly a word would pop out that was completely Appalachian, or sometimes something would pop out that was very New York. But I think she really embraces the blend. She is in New York City for college. She did opt to go to New York City for college. She's in school for fashion design. It's interesting. She's very aware of the different perspective being from North Dakota gives her, even on an industry like that one. I saw a letter she'd written to apply for a sort of mentorship program. And she began by basically just saying straight out, "I'm from North Dakota. People like me don't have access to this industry. If you want to include someone that is going to come at things from a different angle, a different experience, then you need to choose me." And she got chosen. So she's very canny in that way. She knows what she gets from North Dakota, what she gets from her New Yorkness, what she gets from Appalachia. But at heart, if you ask her, she would say, "I am a North Dakotan."
North Dakotan. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you transplanted North Dakotans do for fun over the last how many decades since you've been living here? I mean, you know, you talked about one of your shows was about hunting and the philosophy of hunting. A lot of people hunt in North Dakota. Is that what you do? Do you snowmobile? What do you do for fun around here?
We spend a lot of time, I have for years, and Kim has started the last couple summers, we spend a lot of time biking in the farmland. I will gravel bike, I cycle and I run. In Grand Forks, the Greenway is absolutely the best feature. And so we spend a lot of time. We have a dog. We walk our dog, you know, every day. But I will do 6-8 hour bike rides on the gravel, which is a grid so you can't get lost, and really experience the quiet and the beauty of the crops and the different textures. And every day the gravel roads are a little different. And I wouldn't have been attuned to that before this. And so I think both of us have found ways to take the best of North Dakota and exploit it so that we don't go crazy, right? You know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, we need hobbies, winter, we need downtime, there's winter. And I, of course, I have a fat bike. And so in the winters, I'll be doing the same thing. And I still am totally overwhelmed by the night sky. As someone who grew up in a city, I remember very vividly, I was in about fourth grade, the first time I saw stars. I went to a friend's house upstate New York, and I got out of the car and I looked up and there were stars, and I fell on the ground and just lied on the ground and watched it. The big sky, the sense of the darkness of night. A few months ago, last autumn, we were coming back from Fargo and our alternator died. And Kim was driving and she smartly coasted into the side of the highway and pulled off, and we had to wait about 2 hours for a tow truck. And so we're sitting on I-29 on the edge of probably a sugar beet field, and the night sky is starting to appear, and it was cool enough that there weren't mosquitoes. And as awful as the experience was, it was really lovely. And there's something about the North Dakota night that is unlike any other area and any other region.
It's downright romantic.
Well, there were northern lights that night, too.
Oh, yeah, there were.
So, yeah.
Of course, we were on I-29, so it could be that romantic.
Waiting for a tow for 2 hours, but hey, you got to find it where you can get it, I suppose, in North Dakota. But anyway, North Dakota is a state that opens up the imagination, too, when you look at the sky, look out on the horizon, and that's got to be a good for intellectual stimulation as well. It certainly does with me. But man, 200 episodes of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. This is to the both of you. What are your favorite, maybe a couple favorite episodes that come to mind?
I mean, I loved being interviewed by Jack, and it took a while for him to convince me to do it. The experience was great in part because, in a way, it was the same as when we, you know, if we're home and I'm talking to him about what I do, but it wasn't. I liked to experience that being drawn out, having a supportive interviewer, someone who wasn't going to sort of be adversarial. Jack always, when he has people who are in philosophy departments on the show, he always has to convince them it's not going to be adversarial. And I'd say 50% of them don't believe him until they're actually on the show and he starts asking questions. So I love the episode where our daughter and her friend got to ask Gloria Steinem some questions about feminism. I think one of the absolute best episodes is the Carol Gilligan episode. That's one where people are shocked to find out that Carol Gilligan wasn't here in the studio with him. It felt like the two of them had known each other their whole lives. Like, there was just this sort of instant rapport. There's some people Jack's interviewed, like our friend Danny Goldhagen, that they know each other already, and I sort of know what the rapport. But I like the ones where I can hear the relationship developing of like, oh, she just realized that he's, you know, really smart. Or she just realized he thought that. Or they're connecting around this idea. I would say those are some of my favorites.
Well, it's like when a guest feels like they're seen or heard.
Yeah.
That's something pretty special.
And you can hear that, right? Mm-hmm. You can hear the moment when they're like, oh, I get to just be excited and talk about what interests and excites me. You know, right. That's always awesome to hear.
That's part of the hidden goal of the monologue. The monologue is there primarily for the audience to start anticipating questions, and so the themes don't really take them by surprise. But also, it is a way for me to announce to the guest, okay, you got to step up your game. This is real. I read the book. I thought about it. I know what I'm talking about. You have permission and you are expected to rise up to this occasion. And it's why we don't pre-record the monologue. I wait until the guests are here or connected on the phone, on the internet, and I perform the monologue in front of them while they are listening. Because otherwise, you need to rev up, you need to warm up. And they're all professionals, they're all thoughtful people, they're all experts, and it's a jump start. I think there are a bunch of different categories of episodes that I love. I love the episodes with people I have very close, intimate relationships with. I loved the episode of Kim. For our 10th anniversary, I did a live episode on stage with my father, which I listen to periodically, particularly if I'm missing him or something like that, and that's very meaningful to me. Friends and colleagues whom I have tremendous respect for, those are very, very meaningful for me. There is the category of people who were intellectual heroes for me, that the idea of being able to talk to them, Carol Gillian is one of them. Her book In a Different Voice was profoundly influential for me when I was younger. And having a conversation with her, having a conversation with James Lowen, having a conversation with people who I really have admired for a long time has meant a lot. And then there's the conversations that teach me that I don't know anything, and the conversations that really help me understand something about the world that I just missed. And those are my favorite kind of books, too. There's a book, I tried to get the author on the show and I couldn't get her, but there's a book called The Warmth of Other Suns, which is like, it's a 600-page book on the Great Migration, the migration of African-Americans, descendants of slaves from the rural South right before World War II to the urban cities in the 1970s. And I read that book and I thought, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about history. I don't know anything about people. I don't know anything about, stupid to say the Black experience because that's 27 million things, but I don't know anything. And I read that book and it became one of my most favorite reading experiences, which is why I really wanted the author on the show. That experience of encountering new ideas that shift me on my axis. There's actually, and then there's personal meaningful moments. I have to correct, though it's relevant. Kim said that we knew Danny in advance. We didn't know Danny in advance. Daniel Goldhagen wrote Hitler's Will of the Executioners, which is without question the single best book to explain the Holocaust. And profoundly, again, meaningful to me. And I invited him on the show. And then we became friends because of it. And that in itself was a tremendous gift. But Kim's mentor, Deborah Brandt, is a literacy scholar. And she's on the show actually twice, once to talk about reading and writing, literacy, and once to talk about ghostwriting. And I have always struggled with my identity because both of my parents are artists. My mother is a visual artist. My father is a jazz musician, in addition to their day jobs and things like that. And I grew up with this profound sense that the single most important thing that a human being can do is create art. And that if you're not creating art, you're not doing something meaningful. Now, there's problems with that, but that was my childhood. And I always struggled with not being a fiction writer and not doing all this stuff. And what Deb convinced me, and you can hear it on the radio, I'm getting emotional, is that I'm a writer. That I have spent my whole life doing the one thing that I wanted to do. And understanding that the monologues are writing, understanding that my philosophy books and things like that are writing. The moments where I can have a real human experience with my audience, those are the best.
That listener on I-94 that you're connecting with in that moment, that's, to me, that's art. That's writing as well. Mm-hmm. You know, in radio, people don't realize how much writing goes into conversational radio. There's a lot. So
there's so much stuff behind the scenes, and the experts, you, Craig, Ashley, Tay behind the engineering deck recording, all these experts have brought years and years and years of knowledge, mistakes, stuff like that. All that becomes invisible when it's done right. The listener doesn't have to think about all of the effort. And I will say, since I'm already emotional, that my relationship with Prairie Public has been maybe the most consistent and the most meaningful relationship in my professional life. Bill Thomas, who is no longer the director of radio, when I met with him to pitch the show, he said to me, well, let's do 3 episodes and then we'll see what happens. And I always say, he never told me to stop. And I never understood why he agreed to it. And at some point later on, he said to me, I would never have let anyone else do this but you. No idea why. I mean, it's worked out fine, but, you know, don't understand how he saw that in me, don't understand where the trust came from. And the Prairie Public folks have treated me not just like an equal, but as part of the family from the very first. And were I to lose the show, that would be very hard for me. But were I to lose Prairie Public Radio, I don't know how to deal with that. The fact that Prairie Public is vulnerable right now is such a crime against the community, because there's something tremendously romantic about radio, but there's also something more honest about radio that you don't get in television, even though Prairie Public Television is wonderful. There's something honest and unmediated about the experience of hearing the voices. And you're alone, or you're in your car, or you have your earbuds in, or whatever, and the voice fills you in a way that the visuals don't. And the idea that Prairie Public is vulnerable is baffling to me, because the network is the only network that unifies the entire state. And the radio is the only signal that reaches every single household in the state, not to mention Montana, South Dakota, et cetera, every single household in the state, regardless of economics, regardless of rural or urban, regardless of ethnicity. Are you a new American? Have you been in North Dakota for 7 generations? It reaches everybody with a kind of democratic equality that is unequaled, unrivaled by any other medium. And I get to be a part of that. What more could I ask for?
We could ask for your donation at prairiepublic.org. Just open the red donate link. If that's on a pitch, I don't know what it is. Thanks, Jack.
we are a monthly, sustaining members. Yeah,
well, thank you for that. So 200 shows in. Look, I mean, yeah, we're facing huge challenges just to exist. We're trying. Our audience keeps stepping up, and we need them to keep stepping up if we're going to stay here for another 200 episodes of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. But assuming we do, what's next for you? Because you talked about, like, you know, trying to get an author of a book talking about an experience that you'd like to learn more about. There's a lot to learn out there. It's also a different time that we're in. It's an extraordinary time in 2026, different than even, you know, when you all moved out here, which is not too long before 9/11. I mean, we are in this era now where there's a lot of anti-intellectualism, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, there's just so many confluences of things happening all at once. And that, you know, it speaks to your wheelhouse and the things that you care about. What do you have on the docket? What do you have in your mind for the next 200 shows of Why?
Well, one of the things that is really important is that Craig and I do the monthly segment of Philosophical Currents on Main Street. And one of the fundamental differences is that I think of Why as my show and Main Street as Craig's show. Mm-hmm. And I do the interviews in Why, and Craig interviews me in Philosophical Currents. And Philosophical Currents is about current events. And so I can be more political. I can be more topical. I can have, I don't want to say more of an opinion, but it's more frontline stuff. And that frees me in Why to have a more conceptual approach. I would never have a partisan on the show. I mean, obviously, there are some topics that I might not do, but I would never have a partisan on the show, and I would never have someone who has an agenda that isn't primarily intellectual in nature. And so what that allows me to do is have hard conversations in a way that other people don't have the safety and freedom to do. Our last episode was Philosophy of Suicide, right? That's a tough conversation. A couple years ago, we had Philosophy and Depression. That is a tough conversation. But also, I had one of my favorite episodes. We did it here in the studio. We had a Hindu monk in the studio. And I had an episode on Sharia law. And I had an episode on whether or not we could have a world without borders. I had an episode on, I mean, I've had episodes on violence and things like that. What it allows me to do is to take these conceptual cores and get us to have conversations that hopefully is liberated from the partisan bickering and the one-upmanship and the trying to win the sport of argument. And so I'm constantly looking for stuff that is just interesting. My daughter spent a semester in Florence, Italy as an exchange student. Went to visit her, of course, and she was giving us the tours of the beautiful architecture and art. And I immediately came home and invited a scholar in February. We're having an episode called Do We Still Need the Renaissance? But if it pops into my head, I heard on NPR once this woman who was talking about cuisine, the cooking of empires. And I immediately called her and had her on the show, and that was a wonderful episode. Anything that pops up, if there is a philosophical approach to it, I will consider putting it on the table. And that means I very rarely know what's going to happen 6 months or a year from now. I am currently, I think we've got about 7 or 8 episodes lined up. That's good for me. Sometimes we're really scrambling. So I don't know. It depends what's on the table. It depends what crosses my path and on what people would be interested in.
Well, as you always say in the promo that we still love airing after all these years, why is an empowering question, and it gives you a lot of power to unlock a lot of things, and it's a very liberating word, why. And Kim, you're across from your husband here talking about this 200th episode, and you know, of course, he was getting emotional, understandably. What are your thoughts about this accomplishment, and what do you have to say to Jack on this milestone?
So you asked us earlier about potential culture shock, mm-hmm. you know, moving here. Jack has built something out of the show that I think is tremendously wonderful for many people, for lots and lots of listeners. But it has also created the space that he needed to live in here, right? The show is part of Jack living in North Dakota. I don't know that it would have happened if we had gotten jobs in, I don't know, Austin, Texas, or some other kind of place. And sometimes I think those long bike rides across the prairie, you know, are also integral to thinking about the show, possible topics, other kinds of things. It is hard for me to imagine Jack as Jack without the 18 years of this show. It's just a fundamental part of who he is, and it's a part that I really love.
We love it, too. We're very, very lucky to have such a stimulating, thoughtful program on every month. It's just once a month. By golly, I wish we could bottle it up and unleash it every day. It's always a fun listen, always a challenging listen, and, you know, in a good way. It challenges my own thoughts and beliefs, and you get a rise, whether it's good or bad. Somebody's going to have some sort of opinion and thought about it. And like you said in the promo too, if you want philosophy to be interesting, you have to be interesting. So be interesting if you listen to Why. Pop open the champagne, because Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life turns 200, the 200th episode, Sunday, August 9th. Listen in at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain. Why airs every second Sunday of the month here on Prairie Public. And aren't we glad, Jack and Kim, we appreciate all the hard work that goes into this show, behind the scenes, in front of the mic, the elevation of intellect on our air, and without being snobby about it. And man, that is a mad, mad radio skill. Congratulations, and thanks for making the show for our audience. Both of you.
Thank you.
I end every episode by saying it's an honor to be with you, and that is the most honest part of the show. It's an honor to be here, and it's an honor to have you take the time to talk to us and take the time to record us and the audience. It's a tremendous honor, so thank you.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks, guys.
I'm Bill Thomas, former director of radio for Prairie Public. 200 shows ago, he came to us with a proposal doing a philosophical version of what was then a hit public radio show called Car Talk. So Car Talk, I mean, there's many people around now who haven't heard of it, even though it was so popular when it was on, was two car mechanics taking calls. We talked it over, and we decided to just, okay, we'll give it a try. And it was quite a production early on. Jack is pretty much of a natural at on air, which he's probably a natural at talking in the classroom. He's probably a natural at a dinner party having discussions. He's a good conversationalist. He's responsive. He pays attention to what the other people are saying. He brings in relevant stuff. Does it in a way where, without sounding like he's dumbing things down, he does manage to get into some fairly deep concepts. It was a locally produced program coming out of a local North Dakota campus with a local North Dakota host. And we just felt fairly early on, well, this is to our benefit to have this on. If Jack were in front of me right now, we were talking about this, I would just say, boy, well done. You know, you pulled it together, all the different things it took. You clearly were motivated to make it work. It clearly is something that fits with your personality, fits with your wisdom, fits with your manner, and it's something that has, I think, helped our listeners. I think helped them understand some things that are presented sometimes as very abstruse and confounding subjects. To get to why it's, you know, that's the name, why, right? And to get to why it's worth thinking about these and trying to get into what's behind it and what's understanding it. And I think that helps people live better lives.
Hi, my name is Mick Belts. I have worked with Jack since 2006. I am a faculty member in ethics at the University of North Dakota, and I have known him since I've been here. Well, one of the great things about Why Radio is that Jack is able to make all of the areas of philosophy come alive. So Jack is a person, is a friend, is a wonderful individual. He is absolutely loved by his students and his colleagues and his coworkers and pretty much everybody at the university. Thank you for doing this and being willing to bring together voices from around the world and to see perspectives that we probably wouldn't have heard elsewhere.
I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on the rare occasion that Skip Wood was out of office, I got to engineer the Y Show. I also interviewed Jack. I would say something just intentionally stupid to him, like, if tomato is a fruit, is ketchup a smoothie? And then he would take it to a direction that I was like, bro, I was not expecting a university level response to that, but it would actually always be ha 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 ha, and then he would take it into a place of discovery and of learning, and I always just felt very cared for in a conversation with Jack. He was always aware of his position as being an advocate for the listener. Congratulations, Jack. The world is richer for you being in it. One of my most favorite moments of all time working with you, from getting to be behind the scenes when you're talking with Gloria Steinem, or having a really thoughtful conversation with a swami at a yoga center, is the time that I took a 3-minute and 14-second question out of Y and sent it to you. And I was like, for the love of God, Jack, get to the point. And I sent it to him. I actually had it printed on some transfer paper, and I put it on a t-shirt and gave it to him. And with all the good grace of somebody as fantastic as Jack, he laughed his butt off.
My name is Paul Thumb, and I am professor at UND. I'm also the department chair of Political Science and Public Administration Department. I've known Jack for over 20 years as a colleague here at UND, but also as a friend. One of the things I appreciate about Jack and the show itself is how much he listens and learns. He's tireless in terms of his preparation for his courses, for his writing, and that translates to the show. And, you know, because of that, he elicits a lot of insights from his guests that seemed to genuinely surprise him. You know, longtime listeners of the program will recognize his half laugh, and I would even say his half smile. I know over the radio you can't hear him smile, but you know that he has that half smile when he says something like, "That's really interesting." The electrons in his brain are kind of shooting, they're firing in all directions, and that's a wonderful quality about him. With all due respect, the students either absolutely love him or they really don't like him. He is going to challenge them. He's going to challenge their fundamental assumptions about life, about all sorts of very controversial issues. And he's going to force them into uncomfortable spaces. So when you think about 200 episodes, it's a volume that is measured in minutes through each program, but the minutes are expanded exponentially when you think about how much work he puts into each one of those episodes. So it really makes for an astounding feat to have 200 episodes. I think he should be really proud of himself, and I think sometimes he takes some of this for granted, but the sheer breadth of the catalog is really amazing. And thinking about an issue, I can go back to the archives, and it's not unusual for me to find something on that particular issue. And I still learn stuff.
Hi, this is Skip Wood, former producer at Prairie Public. I had the privilege of engineering the Y Show from its very early days, 16, 17 years ago now. As a philosophy major myself, I was intrigued when Jack suggested a show that looked philosophically at issues from everyday life. Those early episodes were live, always a hazardous adventure. Jack would commute to Fargo from Grand Forks. Somehow, the live disasters were few, and thanks to rapidly improving technology, Jack was eventually able to remain in Grand Forks, and both he and his guests from around the country and even overseas sounded quite good. Thanks to podcasting and streaming, the show became available everywhere. But it takes more than a good idea for a show to last. It requires a great host. When the host can convey enthusiasm and good humor, and the guests are passionate about their topic, that makes it work, makes it enjoyable to listen to. It's thoughtful, at times surprising, and it's often important, providing a deeper understanding of complex issues. Jack is also the producer, picking the topics, picking the guests, and arranging the recording schedule. And the show's music, that's Jack's dad, Mark, a renowned flute player, and Jack's wife, Kim, is the show announcer. Not many shows get by on such a low budget. 200 shows. I'm so glad I got to be part of it. Congratulations, Jack.
Hi, I'm Brian Huschel. I am Vice President for Academic Affairs at Mayville State University currently. And Jack and I got to know each other 25 years ago. He's a great friend, willing to listen, and that reflects in his interviews on Y Radio and his work as a philosopher. You look at the titles of the episodes, and oftentimes they read like an introduction to philosophy or introduction to applied ethics. But he takes those subjects and interviews these top scholars and manages to connect them into just what's going on in the world today. Y Radio has been great work. I'm happy to listen to it all the time.
My name is Adina Weinstein, and Jack Russell Weinstein is my father. Being at the dinner table as a kid, every single night was a discussion. And it was really interesting because it was always a discussion and it wasn't a debate. My parents never treated me from an intellectual standpoint as a kid. They always treated me from an intellectual standpoint as a peer. And I think that that's a really, really amazing way to grow up because you have confidence in your intelligence and not just in academic potential, but in the ways that you can see and interact with the world. I remember being a little kid in Prairie Public when we'd still have to drive down to Fargo before there was all this, you know, you could do it from his computer now. I remember sitting in his lap with the microphone. I have very vivid memories of the radio station when I was a kid. I think I've learned a lot about what he's willing to open himself up to. He'll never shut down a guest, which is something that I really, really enjoy. I like that in the show, I can see him being pushed intellectually at times with guests in ways that I often didn't get to see because I'm not in a university setting with him. And it's really cool to watch or listen to somebody that you admire discover new things about how they think or have new thoughts and figure out how to navigate that. If I was sitting across the dinner table from my dad right now, thinking about the show, I would thank him for doing it because there's a lot of elitism in academia. And I think it takes guts to say everybody can do philosophy and I'm not going to be in New York and I'm going to come to the Prairie and I'm going to come to North Dakota. And I believe as an East Coast academic, that people driving in their car on the highway, you know, Grand Forks to Fargo, can listen to philosophy and they can do it just as well as we can.